Hello everyone, I'm Pascal and welcome to Professors Are Cool People Too. For our final interview of the season, I had the pleasure of speaking with Associate Professor Gregory Pierrot. Professor Pierrot was born and raised in Metz, a city on the eastern side of France, and while enrolled in college there, he was an Americanist. For his undergraduate thesis and MA dissertations, he wrote about 20th century U.S. literature and music. It wasn't until he went back to school at Penn State that he started specializing in African-American literature and more generally in Black studies.
So when I went to college in France, I had to decide between studying English or studying history. Those were my two favorite subjects. And my logic was that if I studied history, then I would most likely no longer study English. Well, if I studied English, I could still study history. So then that's how I decided to major in English. You know, so I did my undergrad and started a PhD. I got a master's and started a PhD in France that I did not finish because I moved here and, you know, there were complications with my dissertation director. That's the nice version. But when I was in the U.S. For a few years, when I moved here, I was just, you know, doing temp jobs, basically. And it wasn't that great. I was also an adjunct at a community college teaching French, which reminded me that I had no interest in teaching French. So when I was doing this, it was my wife who said, you know, you're still writing. I was writing a lot in fanzines and other things. And she said, that's what you want to do. So why don't you go back to school? So when I applied for grad school at that point in time, I actually asked myself, what, you know, I have a chance to actually, you know, do exactly or potentially, you know, claim what I want to do. And at that point in time, I was especially interested in in Black studies, right? I was going to go in an English department, but also was fully aware that being bilingual and having the interests that I have would be something to speak about, right? Like, I didn't necessarily just want to study African-American literature, even though that was my interest, but I was also interested in African-American literature and conversation with, you know, the Caribbean, France, you know, other Black communities of the world. So that is what I spoke about what I wrote about in my application to Penn State. And when they let me in, then, you know, I pretty much did what I wanted to do.
Also, I think you have an interesting perspective having studied here and in France. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about the similarities and differences that you noticed regarding the higher ed here and abroad?
Yeah. So as I said, you know, it was a while back, and I have to think that things have changed to some extent and in ways that I have not seen. So with that caveat, there are also elements that I believe have not changed just because of the way the systems are. And so there are many things that we do in French high schools that, from what I've seen, you don't really get to do in the U.S. until college. In my experience, where I went through, there's like a double system in France when you go to college. There are regular colleges, and there are also those what they call higher schools, right? École supérieure. That sort of prep you to this entirely different, very elitist system of, they're all public, but they're very, they're more difficult to get into. And so you prep for 2 years that are technically your first 2 years of college to take the exam to get into those schools. So that's what I did. And so what that meant is that, contrary to most people who would have to specialize the first year of college, for those 2 years, I kept getting classes in, you know, geography, history, and so on and so forth. But those were really, you know, they grade really hard, and you it's sink or swim. But it's really a good, very good, and good training in writing. What I've grown to understand is that there are very many equivalents to this in the U.S., but it implies a lot of money. And that is a fundamental difference, I think, and I have definitely has no way that it's changed between France and the U.S., is that in France, you can actually go all the way to your PhD spending a minimal portion of what Americans have to spend doing the same thing. The amount of money that you have to pay in the US to go to college is just unbelievable to me. I say this all the time, and I think it's true, though I realize it's, people just look at things differently. But if I'd had to pay that much, I probably never would have gone to college in the US. Certainly not, with the way my parents grew up and the way, the way people work with money. I mean, to go in debt for education is just baffling to me. Not, I understand why people do it, but just if that was the way they ran things in France, I mean, there would be major problems, let's say. And so that also changes the system in a way that, so in France, you can, if you pass the end of high school exam, then you can go to college. They may or may not have enough seats, but you will, nobody's going to stop you. There's no selection at the entrance, or at least there wasn't when I went. But selection happens as you go through college, because they also don't grade anywhere as nicely as they do in the US. Another thing I've noticed, I would say, is that overall in the US, from what I can tell, they value diplomas, especially depending where you went, right? So, I mean, if you go to prestigious schools, then it apparently is worth more than if you went to other places. I wouldn't say that's quite true in France. I mean, there are certainly universities, excuse me, they're more reputed than others for certain specialties and whatnot. But overall, you won't get a diploma unless you deserve it, right? And that is very much related in the to the way people grade. You don't get A's in college in France, unless you're in exact sciences, I guess. In the humanities, it's near unheard of. And part of the reason is, there's an old saying that some professors used when I was still going there, that would say, we grade out of 20 points in France. So they would say 20 is for God and 19 is for your teacher, right? So, but it technically, that's nobody gets above 18, which I guess is what, like A minus. And it's not, getting a C is fine, right? C is a passing grade, and it's not great, but it doesn't, diminish your accomplishment, because that's the point, right? Like, anything above this is shows that you're doing a good job. But C is like, yeah, that's, you've done what you were expected to do. It's not great, but that's fine. Well, in the US, like, people just, I see a lot of people just can't believe it if they get a C or C minus, even though, as far as I'm concerned, that may be what you deserve, right? So then I still struggle with this, right? Because on paper in the US, it should work the same way, but that's not at all how it works in real life. So those, I would say, and the way you value grades, the way you grade, and money, I would say, are the two major differences. But I think they're related to also, bigger systems of value and the way people consider education at large.
Professor Pirro teaches at our Stanford campus and likes it because of the diverse student body and the intimate size. Some of Professor Pirro's favorite courses to teach are music and African-American literature and memory and history and graphic novels, because they highlight how literature is connected to other art forms while being inspired by and part of popular culture. A line from his course description for the former course reads, "In his autobiography, Frederick Douglass notes the profound significance of the sorrow songs sung by the enslaved. Quote, I have sometimes thought that the mere hearing of those songs would do more to impress some minds with the horrible character of slavery than the reading of whole volumes of philosophy on the subject could do." End quote. Close to 100 years later, Leroy Jones provocatively quipped that, quote, "Only in music, and most notably in blues, jazz, and spirituals, i.e. Negro music, has there been a significantly profound contribution by American Negroes." End quote. Both authors underline the crucial role played by music in African-American culture in particular, but also American culture in general. This course proposes to explore the ways in which musical traditions have informed African-American literature.
The course about music, to me, is just, I mean, maybe it's obvious, I like music. It's nice to talk about it. It's not an easy course to teach, I would say. And I've noticed, for I've been taught it several times, as much as people like music, people are, I don't want to say scared, but they really struggle with writing about it, which to me is part of what should make it interesting, but can be kind of hard on people, on students, I've noticed. But To me, that's why it also is interesting, right? Like, all people tend to take this class because they like music and they realize, well, you know, maybe that's what we're gonna do. And yeah, that's what we're gonna do, even though the course is really about music in literature, which sometimes they maybe did not read closely enough and they realize, which is fine too, right? Yeah, I love that course because to me, it's sort of in a macrocosm everything I like about scholarship. Like, it makes connections between things that may not be obviously connected, and it makes connections between things that may not be obviously connected also hierarchically, I want to say, right? I mean, people tend to think, you know, all literature, there's like high literature and low literature, there's high music and low music. But you know, pop music is everywhere, and popular writing is everywhere, and genre writing is everywhere, and they connect in very interesting ways. You can watch, you know, some trashy movie you've seen, and it turns out that, like, you know, they quote Blake or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I always saw people, and I remember this vividly. The very first time I read a poem by William Blake was in an issue of Spider-Man.
In the course description for Memory and History in Graphic Novels, Piero writes, "From its roots in ancestral art, hieroglyphics, and tapestries, to modern-day graphic novels, storytelling in images has long been focused on the recording of events, private and collective. This course will look at a variety of comics and graphic novels exploring stories at the confluence of memory and history, looking at first-person individual trajectories in the turmoil of world events, and how the medium Scott McCloud defines as, quote, juxtaposed, pictorial, and other images in deliberate sequence, end quote, makes for unique and specific approaches to the portrayal and understanding of history."
I am genuinely convinced that it really doesn't matter what you read because those connections are always there if you bother to look for them. So curiosity to me trumps everything else. And what I hope, and you know, I'm sure it works sometimes and sometimes not, but what I hope courses like these might achieve is show how those connections work with specific examples, and maybe examples that will speak directly to some of the students, right? I mean, you know, I try to stay up on contemporary music, so that it's not just, you know, because, you know, but the thing about pop music is, even, you know, 20 years ago it was yesterday for me, but it was before your birth. So I mean, what does it, you know, it's not always relevant. But it becomes relevant when, you know, you realize that that sample is in the song that came out yesterday, right? And so, you know, I really like those genealogies also, because for one, it shows that nothing comes from out of nowhere. But also, hopefully, again, it might titillate people's curiosity to, like, go out and see, well, all right, so, you know, that, you know, I don't know, Nicki Minaj sample, like, was used like four times already. Who used it along the way? What's the conversation between them, right? For example. And then again, you know, music to literature, those are all big conversations. I think it's nice to find ways into them.
Absolutely. And taking that idea a little bit further, what, generally speaking, what do you hope students walk away with after completing a course with you?
You know, I would hope that they would value their own curiosity. I mean, not that they don't, right? I certainly, you know, they don't need me to say this, but what I hope is that they might realize that this is how you become a scholar, if that's what you're interested in. And if that's not what you're interested in, you don't have to make a job out of it, right? I mean, the principle that leads my scholarship is the same principle that led my readings when I was a teenager. There's really no fundamental difference. I would say the difference is I'm older and I have different means, and now it's my job, but, like, essentially, it's not that different. And that curiosity can really feed into anything. I think it's a good thing to do, period, whether or not that's your job. But then it also does train you into doing all sorts of things. You know, I often joke with students that if they do what they're expected to do with the assignments, it's essentially, you know, investigation work. I only say this halfway jokingly, right? We're not, like, you know, sleuthing on people to find out what they do in their private lives. But sometimes we'll be sleuthing on people who are dead, right? So that maybe they won't mind. But all their texts, or, you know, there was sleuthing on writing and culture, right? You know, a few years back already, when the TV show Watchmen on HBO came out, you know, it referred to the Tulsa Massacre of 1921. And that's an interesting thing, because by now people are aware of it. I would say in ways that they were not when that TV show came out, and certainly were even less before that TV show came out. It's become a cultural reference in really odd ways, because, and I say odd because until those TV shows, This was one of those events that historians would say nobody knows this happened, right? It's been buried, and finding out about it is just like one of those really horrendous moments. You think, how could I not know about this? I work on the Haitian Revolution, and at some level, it's the same thing, right? Once you know it about it, you'll see it everywhere. But then it also makes you wonder how you never saw it until you saw it. And that's also what I mean by investigation and sleuthing, right? Like, I'm very history minded, so it tends to be historical, but culturally speaking, it works the same way. Curiosity leads you to those things, right? And it does lead you to make connections. And I think I personally tend to think that it's a good thing in and of itself. But what I like to imagine is that in the process of doing those things about literature, about culture in classes, students might realize that it is also relevant directly to their lives, right? Culture is politics, it's economics. Those they don't stop at music and literature, those connections, right? They connect, books and albums to everything else. And nothing's stopping you from seeing like that is a direct line from music fashion to clothing fashion to commerce, right? I was just talking about that earlier today. Everything can be that serious, but it depends on you, right? As a reader, writer, and researcher.
Outside of the classroom, Professor Pierrot has written for a project initiated and edited by a fellow UConn English professor, Dr. Bhakti Sringapore. I'm sorry if I said that wrong. The project's called Decolonize That: Handbooks for the Revolutionary Overthrow of Embedded Colonial Ideas. The idea arose when the term decolonize was starting to gain some mainstream attention, but like most buzzwords, was getting abused and misused. Professor Sringapore's goal became showcasing concretely what this term could look like in practice.
So the idea was a series of short books, sort of like little manuals, right? I mean, easy to read, accessible, right? Written by scholars, maybe for the most part, but not for scholars, away from the writing that can be fairly jargony and demonstrative for scholarship, but something more mainstream, addressing different issues, different topics where the idea of decolonization might be relevant. And I said, oh, okay, that sounds great. And so she was like, so what would you write? And I said, I don't know. I don't really like. I didn't feel like I work on literature, and like it seemed like not necessarily the best topic, or I didn't feel necessarily like the best person for it. And I sort of said almost as a joke, I said, well, we'd write about hipsters, right? And she said, oh, great idea. Well, okay, so you can do that. And so, like I said, yes. So now it was too late to back out. It wasn't. But I thought, okay, so I'll try that out.
Alongside decolonized hipsters, there's decolonized museums, self-care, and multiculturalism.
So the series is ongoing. The books are excellent. Highly recommend it. And yeah, so that's the overall idea. Again, I still Becky and I still have friends, so I keep up on. I know what's coming, but like she, that's really her project. I'm just one of the authors.
No, but it's still really cool. I actually have Decolonized Hipsters, and I started reading. I'm at like halfway through. I
Yeah.
appreciate it's conversational, like the way you said it's approachable. So I think in that sense, it's like nail on the head, and it's an interesting concept. I really enjoy. I'm enjoying it.
I wasn't just saying that because I was interviewing him. I actually do have a copy. Shout out to Melanie Hepburn, and I am thoroughly enjoying it. It's assertive and thoughtful, and I think it's only fair to share a quote. I remember to this day a friend of mine trying to convince my father to sell him an old Adidas tracksuit top. My father was horrified. He'd owned that old brown thing long enough for it to become his official gardening outfit and couldn't fathom why anyone would want it, much less pay for it. I couldn't explain it either, unmoved as I was by the seductive power of ochre. My friend was dead serious, though, and his request spoke of a rising trend that would soon see luxury thrift stores sprout up all over the place. What had once been the province of the poor and the strapped for cash bohemian was increasingly turning into a cool thing, the clothing equivalent of the DJ's never-ending hunt for an unknown vinyl. Within this same text, it's apparent that Professor Pierrot keeps up with pop culture. This led me to ask him if he's noticing anything within my and the younger, more tech-centric generations that makes him hopeful for the future.
I think younger generations that actually use those tools, which I don't, are not quite the same way. find ways around the problems. And I'm not aware of it because I'm not really that. Again, TikTok is, you know, something I know of and I see it often, but always mediated by something, right? I see it on YouTube, or I see it by way of Instagram, or, you know, it's never TikTok itself, which I don't have. I do know that it is a tool like everything else for mobilization, for political mobilization, for awareness. And this is, you know, to me, that's the positive side. That I'm not aware of this because I'm old, but I have no doubt that young people or younger people will find ways to use this for a lot of good things as well, quite simply. I've seen it, for one thing. And second, it's always true. One thing that makes me hopeful is that, you know, not to speak in very general terms, but again, I've seen it at the micro level, and very much at the macro level, because you hear a lot of people complain about this. I think younger generations are a lot more aware of a lot of things. They're a lot kinder, I mean, generally speaking, right? I mean, there's awareness of a lot of things that were discarded outright or made fun of by older people. You know, when you always hear people, oh, you know, snowflake generation, blah, blah, blah. I think it's funny, you know, because I really think younger people are a lot stronger than we were. And partly because they talk about all sorts of things that we couldn't speak about. That's the exact opposite of weakness, as it turns out. To be able to do this, you know, speak about issues of any kind, racism, you know, microaggressions, mental issues, I mean, everything, right? And to put it out there and to actually work on it. To be able to put your foot down and say, no, I need my time, you know, are things that were unfathomable for people our generation and remain so often. I think that's a very, very interesting show of strength, and it's a very generational thing. So at that level, I'm very hopeful, because I think these attitudes and this way of, you know, and that's related to technology also to some extent, I think, certainly suggests a different way of doing things. Whether or not that pans out, we'll see. I think it has in many ways already. I think, you know, we wouldn't have had the Black Lives Matter movement the way it happened without those technology, without those behaviors. You know, it didn't stop the other wave to come in. But like, I think, that definitely makes me hopeful.
Currently, Professor Pierrot is working on several projects, to name a few. An article on the plays of Archie Shepp, an artist mostly known as a prominent saxophonist of the free jazz scene. He's also trying to write a book in French on the prose fiction of the Black Power era, and he recently joined a group project about La Revue des Colonies.
This project is run by another friend and colleague, Maria Believa Solomon, who teaches at the University of Maryland. And so a magazine that was published in Paris between the mid-1830s and the early 1840s, it lasted for about 8 years, I believe. And the editor was this free man of color from Martinique named Cyril Bisset. So he was born free, but at a time when slavery was still practiced in the French colonies. And so he comes from Martinique in the West Indies. I'll spare you the whole biography, but he was sent in exile because of his politics and sent to France. But what he did in France was start this magazine that was sort of meant as a vehicle for abolitionism and also a counterpoint for what was then common, right? Like pro-slavery, pro-colonization magazines. Not that he was exactly against colonization, but again, that's a nuance for later. But, you know, he started this abolitionist magazine that gave a space for people of color, not just from the French Caribbean, but also, you know, the broader Caribbean, from the U.S., to publish fiction, also political articles, historical articles about the Black world at large. And so this magazine is known, like, for example, in the US, one of the ways you'll see it is because what is currently considered the earliest published African-American short story was actually published in French in that magazine. It was written by a African-American author from Louisiana, who was also writing in French. And so the project, to get back to this, we're trying to see how many of the original issues we can get and to offer a scholarly edition of the whole review. So we'd go through every issue, sort of clarify what the references are, you know, footnotes and everything, And ideally also put this online, right? So the endpoint would be an online digital scholarly edition of the review. But on the way there, we're also, you know, there are several of us working that have slightly different specialties. So we'll probably also write about, you know, different aspects of the magazine. So we're in the early stages of doing this. But yeah, I have good hopes. I think it's gonna be very interesting.
While I was preparing for this interview, I couldn't help but notice that a lot of Professor Pierrot's scholarship is about Haiti. As a Haitian myself, I had to be a little selfish and pick his brain about what draws him to the tiny island I get to call home.
So, Haiti. We sort of got into this in your pre-interview form, but a lot of your scholarship is about Haiti, the Haitian Revolution, mm-hmm. and you're a member of the Haitian Studies Association. So, why Haiti? Like, what draws you to Haitian history?
My family on my mother's side is from Martinique in the Caribbean. This is how I first heard about Haiti. It was through her, through my mother. And it's funny because, you know, if you, she's typically always pretending that, you know, she's not interested in history. She's not interested. She doesn't read books. None of it is true, right? Just for the record. But that's the way she speaks of things. So my dad was always a history buff, yeah, all these history books. And so it would seem like, you know, most of the history came from his side. And it's true to your point, but this came from her and in a very, very subtle ways, right? When I was very little, I was a total nerd and very much, you know, I was into history way too early, but I was very much into Napoleon, which, you know, again, is a very, very typically French disease. But the alternative to Napoleon came through her, right? It was like, well, you know, you might look into what this man did in the Caribbean, which eventually I did. And once I did and got interested in it, you can't, obviously can't avoid Haiti because while he reestablished slavery in Guadeloupe, for example, very violently, it was never abolished in Martinique because Martinique was taken over by England. You know, the French Republic abolished slavery for a while, which is sometimes brag about, but rarely, or at least traditionally, rarely explain how, which was that they were forced to by a people in what is now Haiti, that was then Saint-Domingue, who basically tell them you can abolish slavery and keep this island, or you can, you know, you can lose it. And be, so that's your choice. And so it looks all great. But then once you start looking into things again, what you find out is this amazing event that somehow the greatest countries in the world that were somehow involved in it and managed to basically silence for centuries, right? I mean, you can live an entire life in France and never find out that Napoleon, I try to stay polite here, but that Napoleon's first major defeat was handed to him by formerly enslaved people in the Caribbean. You'd think you would know, right? But no, somehow that never pops up, right? Like, and so this uprising that lasted, like the war lasted over 10 years, involved Great Britain, Spain, France, certainly, the United States, at least commercially. It was one of the major events of its time. As I say often, you cannot find a newspaper, I want to say between 1791 and 1804, that does not mention Haiti, period, anywhere in the US, France, or England. And yet, right, you can live your entire life and never hear about this in any of these countries. So that's why I got interested in it, because the more I look into it, the more it's evident to me that, you know, again, to the selfish element, I guess, is that to me, it's part of my personal history by way of, you know, my Caribbean roots. But the broader version of this is, to me, quite simply, that it belongs to the history of the world. And I think people should know more about it, because that's a part of the history of the world that we can still learn from and that we should be learning from in 2023.
I respect Professor Pierrot's professionalism, but I don't feel the need to mirror it. In case it wasn't clear, Napoleon's first ass-whooping was the Haitian Revolution. In all seriousness, Haitians' unique reputation of unmatched levels of patriotism and nationalism is for this very reason. And I think it's absolutely shameful that we've been ousted from global politics and economics for centuries because we refuse to accept bondage, and how we're infantilized and crippled by the same countries who deny our rightful place alongside them.
A more personal question. Mm-hmm. Do you think the way that, I mean, this is complicated, I know it is, but do you think that the way Haiti is portrayed in media today has anything to do with their reputation as being that first liberated black colony?
I mean, that's the
Right?
short,
Like,
that's the short answer. Yes, I mean,
right?
there's the, you know, there's it's not a matter of blaming, you know, it's easier to say, well, you know, it's 2023, it was literally over 200 years ago, and people love doing that, right? Oh, well, it's so long ago, slavery was so long ago, blah blah blah.
Right.
You know, I forget who was saying something along those lines recently. It's funny what's so long ago and what isn't, right? You know, you can still hear, you know, somehow that the American Constitution is not long enough ago that you can still have, you know, people pretend you have to read it exactly the way it was intended, right? It makes no sense whatsoever, but they can't get over that. But you know, people have to get over slavery anyway. But beyond this, yeah, no, I think it's undeniable. People have written about this much better than I have, but of course, you know, this is a country that was basically ostracized for its success. And I mean, a success on the field is never, you know, on the field of battle, is never a full success in that, you know, whatever you achieve by killing people, right? There was no way around it, just to be clear. But you know what I mean, right? It's like, all right, so you won the war. You'll hear people say, well, the South, you know, won lost the Civil War in the US, but it won the peace, which is really a, you know, very, very deep and very short and accurate way of describing what happened to the US after the end of the Civil War, right? I mean, the South lost, but their ideas lived on and actually, you know, took over, right? As far as Haiti is concerned, I would say something fairly similar, right? Haiti won the war, but they lost the peace. Once they became independent, they fell in, you know, they fell prey to Great Britain, right? Their only half ally in the area. The US refused to do commerce with them for a while, or, you know, under very peculiar conditions. And then eventually France recognized them, you know, for a tribute that ruined the country. You know, there was this major series of articles in the New York Times published earlier last year, you know, showing stuff that historians have known for a while, but like it had the merit of giving it or presenting it to the broader public, showing exactly what we're talking about. And the amount of money is insane, right? It would be insane for big countries like the US or France. And we're talking about a small island surrounded by enemies, you know, for in the middle of the 19th century. Beyond this, culturally speaking, again, they're ostracized, you know, economically, but also culturally and politically. They gain independence only to be ignored and also, you know, assaulted by countries for a while. I mean, usually we hear about the American invasion in 1915, and God knows that was major and terrible, and certainly influenced the way countries have dealt with Haiti since in the 20th and 21st century. But before that, you know, Spain would routinely send, you know, gunboats over there. Spain, Germany, Europe. I mean, it's a long history of people abusing a country for the sake of it being a black independent nation. And Haiti's paid for this for over 200 years. And I think no matter what people might claim, in Canada, in France, in the US, they're still paying for it. Current situation is terrible, and yeah, it's partly what happens within Haiti, undeniably. But what happens within Haiti is never unrelated to the rest of the world. People make money in Haiti. You know, they always say it's costly to be poor. It's very costly to Haiti. You know, Haiti tends to be presented, oh, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere or whatever. It's funny, right? Like for that country to be a place where everybody goes to get their t-shirts made. Or to where you will find all, you know, so many American companies somehow making business. How does that work out? You know, how does this happen? Like none of this is random, and you can only have those two things at the same time if people work on it, and people do work on it, and they've been hostile to Haiti, and again, it didn't start yesterday, right? There is a light here again. That's one of the reasons history is important. So that people don't go around saying, well, Haitian did that to themselves. No, of course they didn't. The question is that how does this keep happening? Precisely because Haiti's not the only country involved in this, and Haitians aren't the only people involved in this. So yeah, to go back to your question, no, I think you cannot separate what's happening in Haiti right now from the history of Haiti and the international, like, history of international behavior towards Haiti.
A few days before this interview, I read an article in the news about the recent influx of gang violence in Haiti titled, "Soon There Will Be No One Left to Kidnap." My knee-jerk reaction was frustration at the part Haitians play in this, but I remember being simply incapable of blaming my people for what's taking place. Professor Perrault's historical insights reminded me of what I already knew, that what's happening now has been years in the making and that those at fault are the ones pointing fingers.
Last question about Haiti, I promise. What, maybe, I don't know if you want to call it an idealistic, romanticized, whatever, but what do you see based on what's happening now and based on the history? Like, what does, in your opinion, I guess, Haiti's future maybe kind of look like? Speculative, totally.
Yeah, my specialty is more 19th and 18th century, so I also don't want to make it sound like I'm a specialist of what's currently going on, because that's definitely not true. You know, I mean, the conversation still is whether or not troops are going to go there again, who might lead them, what they're going to do. You know, notoriously, one of the things that happened last time the UN went in is that they brought cholera with them. And that, you know, not to make metaphors of catastrophes, but I mean, to me, that is very much in the image of the kind of help Haiti has received from the international community. And so, like, one thing I have an issue with is this idea that somehow Haitians can fix this on their own and they need somebody else to come in and swoop in and show them how it's done. I don't think that's true. I do think that there's a hostile elite in charge there. I'm saying that in very general terms. But again, there are people making money off of catastrophe there as well. It's not like you get rid of those people, you know, but it's certainly a question. There are people in Haiti that do want to live well and in peace. It's not like, you know, everybody goes around saying, I'm going to ruin the country today. But the question is, how are they constantly prevented from doing this? Again, there are active forces there, right? Everybody's talking about gangs. Where are those weapons coming from? They don't come from nowhere. They're American weapons. They flow into this country. You know, somebody brings them, right? I mean, again, people are making money off of this. So the idealistic version of this would start by countries like France and Canada and the US leaving Haiti alone, actually, instead of stepping foot in there or pretending to swoop in like saviors, which they obviously have been unable to do. And that's the other thing, right? Everybody will talk about like, oh, failed state, this and that. Like, how many times are we going to see, you know, international coalitions come walk in there and do absolutely nothing? You know, it's just like, how good can you be? Like, what exactly do you do every time you go in there? You know, I only visited Haiti once, but one of the things I did see when I was there, you know, the Red Cross, among other NGOs that have been in there, that went in there after the big earthquake in 2010, got millions of dollars to build houses that never were built. This isn't like, you know, it's not like Haitians are in there like putting the money in their pockets. You know, their money went to the Red Cross. Where did that money go afterwards? Who knows? I don't. I'm sure people have looked into it that know better than I do, but one place I can tell you they didn't go is Haiti. So how does that work, right? That's a good place to start, maybe. Maybe about a little honesty. Maybe, you know, allowing people to be idealistic by actually doing what you claim to be doing in the first place. You know, before we tell Haitians what to do with themselves, how about we actually do what we pretend to do for them? That might be a good place to start. And that could start, you know, we could backtrack a few hundred years and start there. And the rest of it, you know, I am personally actually convinced, because I do believe in democracy and actually do believe that majority of the people want what's best for them. You have to let those people do it, of course. And, you know, if there's anything happening on the ground in Haiti, as in many other places, by the way, it's precisely preventing people from doing what's best for them, because that's not where you can get the most money. You know, again, ideally, that's where I think should start, because I'm not naive. I know it's not going to happen that way. But honestly, you know, I don't have a plan. I don't know how, you know, how to make that work. But I do know that the way it's talked about is constantly, you know, scattering red herrings, so we don't have to talk about the more serious things, including the ways, all the countries that routinely intervene in Haiti are actually directly involved in the problems in Haiti.
With hindsight, these were definitely complex questions to ask, and I did ask them on the fly, but I felt I could ask them because I knew Professor Perrault was equipped with the knowledge to answer them. In short, I trusted him to tell me the truth, which is becoming increasingly and devastatingly hard to come by.
Absolutely. I deeply respect and appreciate your insight on this. Thinking beyond your research and your academia, if you could get more people to care about one thing, what would it be?
Well, I mean, I guess it connects to the earlier answer. I think, you know, when I was talking about curiosity and connections, I think we gain out of understanding the complexity of things. I was just reading a phrase. I'm going to paraphrase. I don't know who the author was, but somebody was saying that basically tyranny is the simplification of everything, right? You're pretending that things are simple. If you make things simple, it's always easier to convince people, right? But in the process, you're most likely lying. I guess, you know, in a somewhat abstract way, I guess, you know, maybe that's something I'd like to convey, right? Or at least contribute to convey, is that if things seem complicated, it's because they are, but it doesn't mean that's not a problem. Is the way things are. And the better we know things, I think the better we can help each other. So the connections I mentioned earlier to me participate in this, right? We will never stop finding how things connect and things get more complex. But again, complex is not complicated, right? Like, things are complex, nuance is important. And the more we are aware of it, I think the better things are.
So our last question is our rapid fire. You know, one question, one answer. So, first one, your favorite genre of music?
It's still punk rock.
Punk rock?
Yeah.
Your favorite city?
New York City.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite punk rock artist? Fugazi? Right, okay. And what's your favorite song by Fugazi?
I would say Merchandise.
Who's your favorite soccer player? You said soccer is your favorite sport.
Those are terrible questions. Zinedine Zidane.
What's your favorite season?
Fall.
Favorite movie?
I'm still gonna say 2001 Space Odyssey. It's still not true, but that's always the first one that comes to my mind, so I'll still say that.
Okay, what's your favorite color?
Black.
Nice. And what's your favorite memory of coming to the United States for the first time?
How many different one that never fails to make me smile is so when I first came here, I was an exchange student at the University of Illinois, and this was the summer of 2000, and the big conversation there was whether or not they were going to get rid of the mascot. It was this super racist mascot called Chief Illiniwek, a white dude that would dress up as an Indian chief and come dancing out during football. It was unbelievably offensive. I've never seen anything like it. And one of the first things they did was take us to a football game. That was an experience in and of itself. But when this happened, I honestly thought I had no idea what I was seeing, right? And so there was a big movement against Chief Illiniwek. And that summer, there was big event against Chief Illiniwek. So all those organizations came to town, the AIM, American Indian Movement, all sorts of organizations, student organizations, came on the quad, so the main lawn at the university, and they had tables out, and they had conversations and concerts and speeches. And it was such a lively way of doing politics. And there's, you know, a lot of politics in France and French universities. But this was really different, and it was really, we were talking about, you know, hope earlier. This was really elating, right, to see, because there was genuine joy. It was very serious, very well informed, and yeah, it was just great to see. And yeah, I mean, I remember this like it was yesterday. Like, it was fun, and also very, again, very, very, very political. And that was, yeah, that was a great moment, and that was, you know, my first year in the U.S.
Awesome. That was my last question.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much again for your flexibility.
Oh, no problem. It's better than grading, so I should say this. I'm still recording.
I really, 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 really loved speaking with Professor Pirro. My dad works for the Board of Ed in Stanford, so when I decided to go to UConn, I remember him telling me to somehow, someway, talk to Professor Pirro. So God would appreciate the full circle moment here. Part of what drives his scholarship and teaching style is what drew me to English in the first place. Its ability to provide a cultural history for almost anything while giving you the space to study different writing styles, techniques, and intentions. English makes space for curiosity in ways that other fields are, in my opinion, just not interested in, and doesn't demand that you approach your interests already equipped with immense amounts of knowledge. All you really need to find whatever it is that you're looking for is curiosity and dedication, and I think that makes English accessible in ways other disciplines simply aren't. I also want to emphasize another point Professor Pirro made. Complex is not complicated. I think the biggest disservice we can do to ourselves is think that we're incapable of fixing what's broken. Our brains are big and beautiful and competent, and it's time we trusted and allowed them to generate and realize solutions. Real solutions. Everything always seems impossible until it's done, right? I mean, look at the Haitian Revolution. Thank you for listening to this episode of Professors Are Cool People Too. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed producing it, and I'll catch you in the next one.